Truck Audio Tales.
Brought to you by BunnySlippers.com. Check out their brand new Dino Sound Slippers. Slippers make a roaring sound every 3 steps. Made with green scaly fabric, soft plush uppers, foam footbeds, non-slip grips on soles, and 3 white claws on each foot. One size fits most, up to women's 10.5, men's 9. Footbed measures 10.5. Black Clock Audio Tales is a daily podcast that reads you a story, either a chapter of a novel or a whole short story. Join us in our exploration of old ghost stories, supernatural fiction, horror tales, folk tales, fantasy, gothic horror, weird fiction, and cosmic horror. And don't forget to join us for our monthly show about the Cthulhu mythos. Look for our podcast near the old wishing well in the blasted heath, wherever you find your podcasts. We suggest Podbean or Apple Podcasts. Find us on the web at pgttcm.com and at Black Clock Audio on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, and Black Clock Audio Tales on YouTube. Welcome to Black Clock Audio Tales. Check out our new website over at www.pgttcm.com. Edited by Daniel Spitzer, music by Kevin MacLeod. The Chamber, Oppressive Gloom, Despair. Welcome to Part 1, Folklore of Great Britain.
Join us at the end of the month when we talk about the Great Old Ones.
The Elfin Knight. There is a lone moor in Scotland which in times past was said to be haunted by an elfin knight. This knight was only seen at rare intervals once in every 7 years or so, but the fear of him lay on all the country round, for every now and then someone would set out to cross the moor and would never be heard of again. And although men might search every inch of the ground, no trace of him would be found, and with the thrill of horror the searching party would go home again, shaking their heads and whispering to one another that he had fallen into the hands of the dreaded knight. So, as a rule, the moor was deserted, for nobody dare pass that way, much less live there. And by it became the haunt of all sorts of wild animals, which made their lairs there, as they found that they were never disturbed by mortal huntsmen. Now in that same region lived two young earls, Earl St. Clair and Earl Gregory, who were such friends that they rode and hunted and fought together, if need be. And as they were both very fond of the chase, Earl Gregory suggested one day that they should go a-hunting on the haunted moor, in spite of the Elfin King. "Certes, I hardly believe in him at all," cried the young man with a laugh. "Methinks 'tis but an old wife's tale to frighten the bairns withal, lest they go straying amongst the heather and lose themselves. And 'tis pity that such fine sport should be lost, because we, two bearded men, pay heed to such gossip." But Earl St. Clair looked grave. "'Tis ill meddling with unchancy things," he answered, "and 'tis no bairn's tale the travellers have set out to cross that moor who have vanished bodily, and never mair been heard of. But it is, as thou sayest, a pity that so much good sport be lost, all because an elfin knight chooses to claim the land as his, and make us mortals pay toll for the privilege of planting a foot upon it. I have heard tell, however, that one is safe from any power that the knight may have, if one weareth the sign of the Blessed Trinity. So let us bind that on our arm, and ride forth without fear." Sir Gregory burst into a loud laugh at these words. "Dost thou think that I am one of the bairns," he said, "first to be frightened by an idle tale, and then to think that a leaf of clover will protect me? No, no, carry that sign if thou wilt. I will trust to my good bow and arrow." But Earl St. Clair did not heed his companion's words, for he remembered how his mother had told him when he was a little lad at her knee, that whoso carried the sign of the Blessed Trinity need never fear any spell that might be thrown over him by warlock or witch, elf or demon. So he went out to the meadow and plucked a leaf of clover, which he bound on his arm with a silken scarf. Then he mounted his horse and rode with Earl Gregory to the desolate and lonely moorland. For some hours all went well, and in the heat of the chase the young men forgot their fears. Then suddenly both of them reined in their steeds, and sat gazing in front of them with affrighted faces. For a horseman had crossed their track, and they both would fain to have known who he was, and whence he came. "By my troth, but he rideth in haste, whoever he may be," said Earl Gregory at last. "And though I always thought that no steed on earth could match mine for swiftness, I reckon that for every league that mine goeth, his would go 7. Let us follow him and see from what part of the world he cometh." "The Lord forbid that thou shouldst stir thy horse's feet to follow him," said Earl St. Clair devoutly. "Why, man, 'tis the Elfin Knight. Canst thou not see that he doth not ride on the solid ground, but flieth through the air, and that, although he rideth on what seemeth a mortal steed, he is really carried by mighty pinions, which cleave the air like those of a bird? Follow him, forsooth, it will be an evil day for thee when thou seekest to do that." But Earl St. Clair forgot that he carried a talisman which his companion lacked, that enabled him to see things as they really were, while the other's eyes were holden. And he was startled and amazed when Earl Gregory said sharply, "Thy mind hath gone mad over this elfin king. I tell thee, he who passed was a goodly knight, clad in a green vesture, and riding on a great black jennet. And because I love a gallant horseman, and would fain learn his name and degree, I will follow him till I find him, even if it be at the world's end." And without another word he put spurs to his horse and galloped off in the direction which the mysterious stranger had taken, leaving Earl St. Clair alone upon the moorland, his fingers touching the sacred sign, and his trembling lips muttering prayers for protection. For he knew that his friend had been bewitched, and he made up his mind, brave gentleman that he was, that he would follow him to the world's end, if need be, and try to deliver him from the spell that had been cast over him. Meanwhile, Earl Gregory rode on and on, ever following in the wake of the knight in green, over moor and burn and moss, till he came to the most desolate region that he had ever been in his life, where the wind blew cold as if from snowfields, and where the hoar-frost lay thick and white on the withered grass at his feet. And there in front of him was a sight from which mortal man might well shrink back in awe and dread, for he saw an enormous ring marked out on the ground, inside of which the grass, instead of being withered and frozen, was lush and rank and green, where hundreds of shadowy elfin figures were dancing, clad in loose transparent robes of dull blue, which seemed to curl and twist round their wearers like snaky wreaths of smoke. These weird goblins were shouting and singing as they danced, and waving their arms above their heads and throwing themselves about on the ground, for all the world as if they had gone mad, and when they saw Earl Gregory halt on his horse just outside the ring, they beckoned to him with their skinny fingers. Come hither," they shouted. "Come tread a measure with us, and afterwards we will drink to thee out of our monarch's loving cup." And strange as it may seem, the spell that had been cast over the young earl was so powerful that in spite of his fear he felt that he must obey the eldritch summons, and he threw his bridle on his horse's neck and prepared to join them. But just then an old and grizzled goblin stepped out from among his companions and approached him. Apparently he dare not leave the charmed circle, for he stopped at the edge of it. Then, stooping down and pretending to pick up something, he whispered in a hoarse whisper, "I know not whom thou art, nor from whence thou comest, Sir Knight, but if thou lovest thy life, see to it that thou comest not within this ring, nor joinest with us in our feast. Else will thou be for ever undone." But Earl Gregory only laughed. "I vowed that I would follow the Green Knight," he replied, "and I will carry out my vow, even if the venture leadeth me close to the nethermost world." And with these words he stepped over the edge of the circle, right in amongst the ghostly dancers. At his coming they shouted louder than ever, and danced more madly and sang more lustily. Then, all at once, a silence fell upon them, and they parted into two companies, leaving a way through their midst, up which they signed to the earl to pass. He walked through their ranks till he came to the middle of the circle, and there, seated at a table of red marble, was the knight whom he had come so far to seek, clad in his grass-green robes. And before him on the table stood a wondrous goblet, fashioned from an emerald, and set round the rim with blood-red rubies. and this cup was filled with heather ale, which foamed up over the brim. And when the knight saw Sir Gregory, he lifted it from the table, and handed it to him with a stately bow. And Sir Gregory, being very thirsty, drank. And as he drank, he noticed that the ale in the goblet never grew less, but ever foamed up to the edge, and for the first time his heart misgave him, and he wished that he had never set out on this strange adventure. But alas, the time for regrets had passed, for already a strange numbness was stealing over his limbs, and a chill pallor was creeping over his face, and before he could utter a single cry for help, the goblet dropped from his nerveless fingers, and he fell down before the Elfin King like a dead man. Then a great shout of triumph went up from all the company, for if there was one thing which filled their hearts with joy, it was to entice some unwary mortal into their ring and throw their uncanny spell over him, so that he must needs spend long years in their company. But soon their shouts of triumphs began to die away, and they muttered and whispered to each other with looks of something like fear on their faces, for their keen ears heard a sound which filled their hearts with dread. It was the sound of human footsteps, which were so free and untrammeled that they knew at once that the stranger, whoever he was as yet untouched by any charm. And if this were so, he might work them ill and rescue their captive from them. And what they dreaded was true, for it was the brave Earl St. Clair who approached, fearless and strong, because of the holy sign he bore. And as soon as he saw the charmed ring and the eldritch dancers, he was about to step over its magic border, when the little grizzled goblin who had whispered to Earl Gregory came and whispered to him also. "Alas, alas!" he exclaimed, with a look of sorrow on his wrinkled face. "Hast thou come as thy companion came, to pay thy toll of years to the Elfin King? Oh, if thou hast wife or child behind thee, I beseech thee, by all that thou holdest sacred, to turn back, ere it be too late." "Who art thou, and from whence hast thou come?" asked the Earl, looking kindly down at the little creature in front of him. "I came from the country that thou hast come from," wailed the goblin, "for I was once a mortal man, even as thou. But I set out over the enchanted moor, and the Elfin King appeared in the guise of a beauteous knight, and he looked so brave and noble and generous, that I followed him hither, and drank of his hither ale, and now I am doomed to bide here, till 7 long years be spent. As for thy friend, Sir Earl, he too hath drunk of the accursed draught, and he now lieth as dead at our lawful monarch's feet. He will wake up, 'tis true, but it will be in such a guise as I wear, and to the bondage with which I am bound." "Is there naught I can do to rescue him?" cried Earl St. Clair eagerly, "ere he taketh on him the elfin shape? I have no fear of the spell of his cruel captor, for I bear the sign of one who is stronger than he. Speak speedily, little man, for time presseth." "There is something that thou couldst do, Sir Earl," whispered the goblin, "but to essay it were a desperate attempt, for if thou failest, then could not even the power of the blessed sign save thee." "And what is that?" asked the Earl impatiently. "Thou must remain motionless," answered the old man, "in the cold and frost till dawn break, and the hour cometh when they sing matins in the holy church. Then must thou walk slowly 9 times round the edge of the enchanted circle, and after that thou must walk boldly across it, to the red marble table where sits the Elfin King. On it thou wilt see an emerald goblet studded with rubies and filled with heather ale. That thou must secure and carry away, but whilst thou art doing so, let no word cross thy lips, for this enchanted ground whereon we dance may look solid to mortal eyes, but in reality it is not so. 'Tis but a quaking bog, and under it is a great lake, wherein dwelleth a fearsome monster, and if thou so much as utter a word, while thy foot resteth upon it, thou wilt fall through the bog and perish in the waters beneath." So saying, the grisly goblin stepped back among his companions, leaving Earl St. Clair standing alone on the outskirts of the charmed ring. There he waited, shivering with cold, through the long dark hours, till the gray dawn began to break over the hilltops, and with its coming the elfin forms before him seemed to dwindle and fade away. And at the hour when the sound of the matin bell came softly pealing from across the moor, he began his solemn walk. Round and round the ring he paced, keeping steadily on his way. Although loud murmurs of anger like distant thunder rose from the elven shades, and even the very ground seemed to heave and quiver, as if it would shake this bold intruder from its surface. But through the power of the blessed sign on his arm, Earl St. Clair went on unhurt. When he had finished pacing round the ring, he stepped boldly onto the enchanted ground, and walked across it. And what was his astonishment to find that all the ghostly elves and goblins whom he had seen were lying frozen into tiny blocks of ice, so that he was sore put to it to walk amongst them without treading upon them. And as he approached the marble table, the very hairs rose on his head at the sight of the elven king sitting behind it, stiff and stark like his followers, while in front of him lay the form of Earl Gregory, who had shared the same fate. Nothing stirred save two coal-black ravens who sat, one on each side of the table, as if to guard the emerald goblet, flapping their wings and croaking hoarsely. When Earl St. Clair lifted the precious cup, they rose in the air and circled round his head, screaming with rage, and threatening to dash it from his hands with their claws, while the frozen elves, and even their mighty king himself, stirred in their sleep, and half sat up as if to lay hands on this presumptuous intruder. But the power of the holy sign restrained them, else had Earl St. Clair been foiled in his quest. As he retraced his steps, awesome and terrible were the sounds that he heard around him. The ravens shrieked and the frozen goblins screamed, and up from the hidden lake below came the sound of the deep breathing of the awful monster who was lurking there, eager for prey. But the brave Earl heeded none of these things, but kept steadily onwards, trusting in the might of the sign he bore. And it carried him safely through all the dangers, and just as the sound of the matin bell was dying away in the morning air, he stepped on to solid ground once more, and flung the enchanted goblet from him. And lo, every one of the frozen elves vanished, along with their king and his marble table, and nothing was left on the rank green grass save Earl Gregory, who slowly woke from his enchanted slumber and stretched himself and stood up, shaking in every limb. He gazed vaguely round him, as if he scarce remembered where he was. And when, after Earl St. Clair had run to him and had held him in his arms till his senses returned and the warm blood coursed through his veins, the two friends returned to the spot where Earl St. Clair had thrown down the wondrous goblet. They found nothing but a piece of rough gray windstone, with a drop of dew hidden in a little crevice, which was hollowed in its side. To say to the new moon, "New moon, true moon, tell unto me, if my ain true love, he will marry me. If he marry me in haste, let me see his bonny face. If he marry me betide, let me see his bonny side. Gan he marry now me awa, turn his back and gae awa." Habitrot the Spinstress. In bygone days, in an old farmhouse which stood by a river, there lived a beautiful girl called Maisie. She was tall and straight, with auburn hair and blue eyes, and she was the prettiest girl in all the valley. And one would have thought that she would have been the pride of her mother's heart. But instead of this, her mother used to sigh and shake her head whenever she looked at her. And why? Because in those days all men were sensible, and instead of looking out for pretty girls to be their wives, they looked out for girls who could cook and spin, and who gave promise of becoming notable housewives. Maisie's mother had been an industrious spinner, but alas, to her sore grief and disappointment, her daughter did not take after her. The girl loved to be out of doors, chasing butterflies and plucking wildflowers, far better than sitting at her spinning wheel. So when her mother saw one after another of Maisie's companions, who were not nearly so pretty as she was, getting rich husbands, she sighed and said, Woe's me, child, for methinks no brave wooer will ever pause at our door while they see thee so idle and thoughtless. But Maisie only laughed. At last her mother grew really angry, and one bright spring morning she laid down 3 heads of lint on the table, saying sharply, "I will have no more of this dallying. People will say that it is my blame that no wooer comes to seek thee. I cannot have thee left on my hands to be laughed at as the idle maid who would not marry. So now thou must work, and if thou hast not these heads of lint spun into 7 hanks of thread in 3 days, I will e'en speak to the mother at St. Mary's Convent, and thou wilt go there and learn to be a nun." Now, though Maisie was an idle girl, she had no wish to be shut up in a nunnery, so she tried not to think of the sunshine outside, but sat down soberly with her distaff. But alas, she was so little accustomed to work that she made but slow progress, and although she sat at the spinning wheel all day and never once went out of doors, she found at night that she had only spun 1/2 a hank of yarn. The next day it was even worse, for her arms ached so much she could only work very slowly. That night she cried herself to sleep, and next morning, seeing that it was quite hopeless to expect to get her task finished, she threw down her distaff in despair and ran out of doors. Near the house was a deep dell through which ran a tiny stream. Maisie loved this dell. The flowers grew so abundantly there. This morning she ran down to the edge of the stream and seated herself on a large stone. It was a glorious morning. The hazel trees were newly covered with leaves, and the branches nodded over her head and showed like delicate tracery against the blue sky. The primroses and sweet-scented violets peeped out from among the grass, and a little water wagtail came and perched on a stone in the middle of the stream, and bobbed up and down till it seemed as if he were nodding to Maisie, and as if he were trying to say to her, "Never mind, cheer up." But the poor girl was in no mood that morning to enjoy the flowers and the birds. Instead of watching them as she generally did, she hid her face in her hands and wondered what would become of her. She rocked herself to and fro as she thought how terrible it would be if her mother fulfilled her threat and shut her up in the convent of St. Mary, with the grave, solemn-faced sisters who seemed as if they had completely forgotten what it was like to be young, and run about in the sunshine, and laugh, and pick the fresh spring flowers. "Oh, I could not do it, I could not do it," she cried at last. "It will kill me, it would kill me to be a nun." "And who wants to make a pretty wench like thee into a nun?" asked a queer, cracked voice quite close to her. Maisie jumped up and stood staring in front of her, as if she had been moonstruck, for just across the stream from where she had been sitting, there was a curious boulder with a round hole in the middle of it, for all the world like a big apple with the core taken out. Maisie knew it well. She had often sat upon it, and wondered how the funny hole came to be there. It was no wonder that she stared, for seated on this stone was the queerest little old woman that she had ever seen in her life. Indeed, had it not been for her silver hair and the white mutch with the big frill that she wore on her head, Maisie would have taken her for a little girl. She wore such a very short skirt, only reaching down to her knees. Her face inside the frill of her cap was round, and her cheeks were rosy, and she had little black eyes which twinkled merrily as she looked at the startled maiden. On her shoulders was a black and white checked shawl, and on her legs, which she dangled over the edge of the boulder, she wore black silk stockings and the neatest little shoes with great silver buckles. In fact, she would have been quite a pretty old lady had it not been for her lips, which were very long and very thick, and made her look quite ugly in spite of her rosy cheeks and black eyes. Maisie stood and looked at her for such a long time in silence that she repeated her question. "And who wants to make a pretty wench like thee into a nun? More likely that some gallant gentleman should want to make a bride of thee." "Oh, no," answered Maisie. "My mother says no gentleman would look at me, because I cannot spin." "Nonsense," said the tiny woman. "Spinning is all very well for old folks like me, My lips, as thou seest, are long and ugly, because I have spun so much, for I always wet my fingers with them, the easier to draw the thread from the distaff. No, no, take care of thy beauty, child. Do not waste it over the spinning wheel, nor yet in a nunnery. If my mother only thought as thou dost, replied the girl sadly, and encouraged by the old woman's kindly face, she told her the whole story. Well, said the old dame, I do not like to see pretty girls weep. What if I were able to help thee and spin the lint for thee? Maisie thought that this offer was too good to be true, but her new friend bade her run home and fetch the lint, and I need not tell you that she required no second bidding. When she returned, she handed the bundle to the little lady, and was about to ask her where she should meet her in order to get the thread from her when it was spun, when a sudden noise behind her made her look round. She saw nothing, but what was her horror and surprise when she turned back again, to find that the old woman had vanished entirely, lint and all. She rubbed her eyes and looked all round, but she was nowhere to be seen. The girl was utterly bewildered. She wondered if she could have been dreaming, but no, that could not be. There were her footprints leading up to the bank and down again, where she had gone for the lint and brought it back, and there was the mark of her foot wet with dew on a stone in the middle of the stream, where she had stood when she had handed the lint up to the mysterious little stranger. What was she to do now? What would her mother say when, in addition to not having finished the task that had been given her, she had to confess to having lost the greater part of the lint also? She ran up and down the little dell, hunting amongst the bushes and peeping into every nook and cranny of the bank, where the old woman might have hidden herself. It was all in vain, and at last, tired out with the search, she sat down on the stone once more, and presently fell fast asleep. When she awoke, it was evening. The sun had set, and the yellow glow on the western horizon was fast giving place to the silvery light of the moon. She was sitting, thinking of the curious events of the day, and gazing at the great boulder opposite, when it seemed to her as if a distant murmur of voices came from it. With one bound she crossed the stream and clambered on to the stone. She was right. Someone was talking underneath it, far down in the ground. She put her ear close to the stone and listened. The voice of the queer little old woman came up through the hole. Ho, ho, my pretty little wench! Little knows that my name is Habitrot. Full of curiosity, Maisie put her eye to the opening, and the strangest sight that she had ever seen met her gaze. She seemed to be looking through a telescope into a wonderful little valley. The trees there were brighter and greener than any that she had ever seen before, and there were beautiful flowers quite different from the flowers that grew in her country. The little valley was carpeted with the most exquisite moss, and up and down it walked her tiny friend, busily engaged in spinning. She was not alone, for round her were a circle of other little old women, who were seated on large white stones, and they were all spinning away as fast as they could. Occasionally one would look up, and then Maisie saw that they all seemed to have the same long, thick lips that her friend had. She really felt very sorry, as they all looked exceedingly kind, and might have been pretty had it not been for this defect. One of the spinstresses sat by herself and was engaged in winding the thread which the others had spun into hanks. Maisie did not think that this little lady looked so nice as the others. She was dressed entirely in gray and had a big hook nose and great horn spectacles. She seemed to be called Slatly Mab, for Maisie heard Habitrot address her by that name, telling her to make haste and tie up all the thread, for it was getting late, and it was time that the young girl had it to carry home to her mother. Maisie did not quite know what to do or how she was to get the thread, for she did not like to shout down the hole, in case the queer little old woman should be angry at being watched. However, Habitrot, as she called herself, suddenly appeared on the path beside her with the hanks of thread in her hand. "Oh, thank you," cried Maisie. "What can I do to show you how thankful I am?" "Nothing," answered the fairy, "for I do not work for reward. Only do not tell your mother who span the thread for thee." It was now late, and Maisie lost no time in running home with the precious thread upon her shoulder. When she walked into the kitchen, she found that her mother had gone to bed. She seemed to have had a busy day, for there, hanging up in the wide chimney, in order to dry, were 7 large black puddings. The fire was low, but bright and clear, and the sight of it and the sight of the puddings suggested to Maisie that she was very hungry, and that fried black puddings were very good. Flinging the thread down on the table, she hastily pulled off her shoes, so as not to make a noise and awake her mother, and getting down the frying pan from the wall, she took one of the black puddings from the chimney and fried it and ate it. Still she felt hungry, so she took another, and then another, so they were all gone. Then she crept upstairs to her little bed and fell fast asleep. Next morning her mother came downstairs before Maisie was awake. In fact, she had not been able to sleep much for thinking of her daughter's careless ways, and had been sorrowfully making up her mind that she must lose no time in speaking to the abbess of St. Mary's about this idle girl of hers. What was her surprise to see on the table the 7 beautiful hanks of thread, while on going to the chimney to take down a black pudding to fry for breakfast, she found that every one of them had been eaten. She did not know whether to laugh for joy that her daughter had been so industrious, or to cry for vexation because all her lovely black puddings, which she had expected would last for a week at least, were gone. "My daughter's spun, seein', seein', seein'. My daughter's eaten, seein', 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 and all before daylight." Now, I forgot to tell you that about 1/2 mile from where the old farmhouse stood, there was a beautiful castle, where a very rich young nobleman lived. He was both good and brave as well as rich, and all the mothers who had pretty daughters used to wish that he would come their way some day and fall in love with one of them. But he had never done so, and everyone said, "He is too grand to marry any country girl. One day he will go away to London town and marry a duke's daughter." Well, this fine spring morning, it chanced that this young nobleman's favorite horse had lost a shoe, and he was so afraid that any of the grooms might ride it along the hard road, and not on the soft grass at the side, that he said he would take it to the smithy himself. So it happened that he was riding along by Maisie's garden gate, as her mother came into the garden singing these strange lines. He stopped his horse and said good-naturedly, "Good day, madam. And may I ask why you sing such a strange song?" Maisie's mother made no answer, but turned and walked into the house, and the young nobleman, being very anxious to know what it all meant, hung his bridle over the garden gate and followed her. She pointed to the 7 hanks of thread lying on the table and said, "This hath my daughter done before breakfast." Then the young man asked to see the maiden who was so industrious, and her mother went and pulled Maisie from behind the door, where she had hidden herself when the stranger came in, for she had come downstairs while her mother was in the garden. She looked so lovely in her fresh morning gown of blue gingham, with her auburn hair curling softly round her brow, and her face all over blushes at the sight of such a gallant young man, that he quite lost his heart and fell in love with her on the spot. "Ah," said he, "my dear mother always told me to try and find a wife who was both pretty and useful, and I have succeeded beyond my expectations. Do not let our marriage, I pray thee, good dame, be too long deferred." Maisie's mother was overjoyed, as you may imagine, at this piece of unexpected good fortune, and busied herself in getting everything ready for the wedding. But Maisie herself was a little perplexed. She was afraid that she would be expected to spin a great deal when she was married and lived at the castle, and if that were so, her husband was sure to find out that she was not really such a good spinstress as he thought she was. In her trouble, she went down, the night before her wedding, to the great boulder by the stream in the glen, and climbing up on it, she laid her head against the stone and called softly down the hole, "Habitrot, dear Habitrot." The little old woman soon appeared, and with twinkling eyes asked her what was troubling her so much. just when she should have been so happy, and Maisie told her. "Trouble not thy pretty head about that," answered the fairy, "but come here with thy bridegroom next week when the moon is full, and I warrant that he will never ask thee to sit at a spinning wheel again." Accordingly, after all the wedding festivities were over and the couple had settled down at the castle, on the appointed evening Maisie suggested to her husband that they should take a walk together in the moonlight. She was very anxious to see what the little fairy would do to help her, for that very day he had been showing her all over her new home, and he had pointed out to her the beautiful new spinning wheel made of ebony, which had belonged to his mother, saying proudly, "Tomorrow, little one, I shall bring some lint from the town, and then the maids will see what clever little fingers my wife has." Maisie had blushed as red as a rose as she bent over the lovely wheel, and then felt quite sick as she wondered whatever she would do if Habitrot did not help her. So on this particular evening, after they had walked in the garden, she said that she should like to go down to the little dell and see how the stream looked by moonlight. So to the dell they went. As soon as they came to the boulder, Maisie put her head against it and whispered, "Habitrot, dear Habitrot!" And in an instant the little old woman appeared. She bowed in a stately way, as if they were both strangers to her, and said, "Welcome, sir and madam, to the spinster's dell." And then she tapped on the root of a great oak tree with a tiny wand, which she held in her hand, and a green door, which Maisie never remembered having noticed before, flew open, and they followed the fairy through it into the other valley which Maisie had seen, through the hole in the great stone. All the little old women were sitting on their white chucky stones, busy at work, only they seemed far uglier than they had seemed at first, and Maisie noticed that the reason for this was, instead of wearing red skirts and white muches, as they had done before, they now wore caps and dresses of dull gray, and instead of looking happy, they all seemed to be trying who could look most miserable, and who could push out their long lips furthest, as they wet their fingers to draw the thread from their distaffs. "Save us and help us, what a lot of hideous old witches!" exclaimed her husband. "Whatever could this funny old woman mean by bringing a pretty child like thee to look at them? Thou wilt dream of them for a week and a day. Just look at their lips!" And pushing Maisie behind him, he went up to one of them and asked her what had made her mouth grow so ugly. She tried to tell him, but all the sound that he could hear was something that sounded like spin. He asked another one, and her answer sounded like this, span. He tried a third, and hers sounded like spun. He seized Maisie by the hand and hurried her through the green door. "By my troth," he said, "my mother's spinning wheel may turn to gold ere I let thee touch it, if this is what spinning leads to. Rather than that thy pretty face should be spoilt, the linen chests at the castle may get empty and remain so forever." So it came to pass that Maisie could be out of doors all day, wandering about with her husband, and laughing and singing to her heart's content. And whenever there was lint at the castle to be spun, it was carried down to the big boulder in the dell and left there, and Habitrot and her companions spun it, and there was no more trouble about the matter.